afternoon. Welcome. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I am Mike Deason.
I am Laureen Jaffe.
And my headphones are not working, so this is sort of crazy. We also want to say that the opinions expressed by the hosts are not necessarily those opinions of WMNF, just ours.
That's right. We're
glad you're here. Laureen, talk for a second, which I know we'll
all
have
right,
no problem.
Yeah,
try another
right, set. So Mike's trying to figure out what's going on with his headphones. So we still have the music playing in the background.
I can hear you on
all
this
right,
one.
There
all right.
We go.
I didn't know the music wasn't playing in the background because I didn't have a headset. Now, here we are.
Welcome.
What a day. What a day. We have a wild show today. First off, I want to say this has nothing to do with Judaism. This is the Palindrome Day.
I'm sorry, what?
It is 02-02-2020.
Oh.
And this is the first time in 903 years that we've had a palindrome day. And the next one is I can't remember how many years away, but we won't be around for that one, whatever it is. Palindrome, you know, words spelled Otto,
yes,
Otto and all that
yes,
stuff.
Yeah. Okay, there I was going, it's a what day?
Yeah, palindrome day.
So it is February 2nd, 2020. Lots of great things this week. So we are going to talk about, we've got a great segment coming up with the city councilman regarding an issue that occurred earlier this week. But it goes to the conversation of anti-Semitism. The statement made by this particular councilman was, quote, "We're getting Jewed," unquote. We've had some great dialogues with him. And I think it's an opportunity for us, obviously, to continue that dialogue of things that sometimes people say things they don't realize is anti-Semitic and continue our conversation as we educate people. So looking forward to that dialogue, and that'll be at 12:30.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. We're going to obviously talk about the peace plan, but also let's do a light thing at the top. Today is
yes.
Super Bowl Sunday.
It is, and yeah, we have...
Mitchell Schwartz, a Jewish NFL player, is... playing today for the Kansas City Chiefs. And my favorite line is the opening line of this article that I saw. It says that his parents wouldn't let him play football until after his bar mitzvah preparations.
I think it's hilarious.
I think that is great.
But this goes to our point of, you know, where are the Jews in American sports? Here we go. Here's a perfect example of a Jewish football player. Not many, but it is. It's exciting, and that was an adorable statement.
Yeah, I thought it was great. And a Jewish guy on the offensive line, although my son played at Plant, and he played defensive line, but he's adopted. My son is adopted. Doesn't look anything like me. When he was bar mitzvahed, he was blonde and blue-eyed and just didn't look it. And he's huge. He's just huge.
But, so he's meant to be a good football player. Well, we also have Edelman. I mean, obviously the Patriots are not in the Super Bowl this year, but he's had a lot of success. So just to point out another very successful Jewish NFL player. So that's pretty exciting. Exciting. It is but lots of things happen.
But you know,
this
the Bucks have a Jewish football player.
Who do we have?
Ali Marpet.
Well, there you
who's
go.
Who's on the he's on the offensive line as well. I don't know. Quite candidly, I don't know how much Ali Marpet embraces his Judaism, but Schwartz does, and his brother Jeff, who's also an offensive lineman in the NFL. They grew up together, obviously, and they really embrace their Judaism and talk about it. They have a book, Eat My Schwartz, Our Story of NFL Football, Food, Family, and Faith. They're the first Jewish brothers to play football since Ralph and Arnold Horween. Do you remember them? Neither do I. They played in 1923. I had never heard of Sid Luckman, who was a quarterback with the Bears, was Jewish also. But it's a thin book on Jewish football players in the NFL. I must admit.
Is.
Yeah,
it sure is. So this is four season with the Kansas City. So you know, it'd be nice to. I don't want to get any fans angry, but you know, it'd be nice if he had a nice win. More reasons for his mother to cavil about. But it is amazing, and that was a really nice book that his brother wrote with him. So
okay, can I? One other thing on football that I'll move on. I read an article.
Yes.
I don't know if I sent it to you, but I just might have read it someplace else. That when after a win, a player will go, I want to thank God for this.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, what about the losers? I mean, God doesn't like the losers. I always wonder about that. He's going to lay back and put his feet up and say, I'm going to take day off and watch the Super Bowl.
That's a very intense, you know, theological discussion. Yeah. I don't know that we can get into that.
I just wonder, you know, I would think that there are more important things that he cares about than cares about who wins the football game. Whenever I see a player say that, I always go.
Well, I think you know, in that sense, it's not necessarily thanking God, you know, for the blessing that helped them personally. I think that's okay. I don't want to condemn people for their personal faith.
It makes me laugh at the end of the game today when the most valuable player comes. If you're watching that, and if he says that, think of me, and everybody can laugh and go, okay, Deason is just going crazy again, you know.
It's fine. But we had something else interesting happen this week. So I love this with them. You know, Microsoft, like Google and so many of the high-tech companies here in the U.S., they have significant offices in Israel. And so there is an Israeli tech team working with Microsoft in Israel that is developing the virtual medical assistant. They are the ones that are behind that virtual medical assistant that was launched by Microsoft last year. And it's really incredible. You have some major health insurance programs, including, for instance, Premier Blue Cross, thinking about using these virtual healthcare assistants to have dialogue with patients and sort of maybe answer. They're not intended to replace a doctor or nurse, but sometimes you need immediate answers and responses. So you have these virtual healthcare professionals, in essence, that, you know, they use algorithms and they're having dialogue and talking with people that need, you know, immediate assistance sometimes. So I think this is really, it's an interesting, you know, as we start using more and more AI, thinking about the way it can impact various fields. I mean, we see it all the time in the legal field. Here it is in the medical field. But you know, there's also this concern that it replaces people, it replaces jobs, which is always the other side of the dialogue.
Right.
Very interesting. But this is something that I think we're going to be seeing more and more of. And it's got that funky picture of the robot, which, you know, that would creep me out a little bit if I was talking to a robot that looked like that, telling me, about my personal health.
That's right. And here's what I prescribed for you. Yeah, I would agree. Did you see, I didn't send it to you, I didn't even print it out, that the company that Jack Roth is working with. He was on with a STEMRAD.
Oh yeah, Jack Ross. Yeah.
Jack Ross. That was it.
Yes.
They had from space. Their product was shown from space.
Right. So that's for everybody listening. So Jack Ross is the U.S. Vice President of Sales in North America for the company STEMRAD, which is an Israeli company that specializes in making radiation products, anti-radiation. And this one was an anti-radiation vest for astronauts that's on the International Space Station right now. So, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
very cool.
It's very cool. And then I remind everybody again, because I'm a Tampa Bay Lightning fan. I'm a hockey fan. And it does have the Tampa Bay Lightning insignia on it, as well as the American and the U.S. and the American and the Israeli flags on it. So very cool.
And that company is part of FIBA.
Right.
Which is based at the Glaser JCC and where they bring Israeli companies over here. So it really has a huge, huge connection to the Tampa Bay area.
And Florida in general. Right. I mean, the Florida Israel Business Accelerator is doing incredible things throughout the state and just bringing these companies in. So lots of exciting stuff. In fact, maybe just a quick little promo, because I think in March we will have the executive director of FIBA on, as well as one or two of the new companies come over. So yeah, so stay tuned for that.
You know, one other thing is, speaking of the Glaser JCC, I was in an event last night for StageWorks. It's a local theater company, and it just blows me away what a great facility that is for events. I know we've been at events together there.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I remember when they used to have wrestling matches at Homer Hesterly. I did some stories there. And to think that we have this wonderful facility that's not only for Jewish people. There are a lot of organizations. I moderated a debate there during the mayoral thing for some organization. It is just an unbelievable jewel in our community, and everybody who's Jewish should be proud of it, and you ought to go and visit it if you have never been there. It is an amazing facility.
So Elvis Presley has played there, right? They did all the wrestling matches. JFK actually spoke there right before he flew to
Dallas. Right, in 63, absolutely.
I guess Teddy Roosevelt, the Rough Riders, camped there at some point.
It was a dump.
So before the local Tampa Federation, JCC, he purchased the land and did a massive renovation. Yeah, yeah. I walked through that place, and I mean, it was...
Oh, you saw it beforehand?
Oh, it was disgusting. Yeah. I mean, it really, because it lay dormant and unused for many years.
Wait, Laureen, when it was being used, it was a dump.
There you go.
I'm telling you. Okay, let's get on to the serious stuff, which we may disagree on.
Right.
The big news also this week was the peace plan.
It was. It was part two of the peace plan, right? Mm-hmm. So both Bibi Netanyahu and the opposition leader Benny Gantz were both invited to the White House for private discussions before the press conference discussing the details of part two of the peace plan. And I thought it was interesting too. You know, you had members of from I believe it was Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain. Present in the audience for that press conference at the White House, but other Arab countries too. Obviously, Jordan, the King of Jordan, was very much involved in the negotiations and working with the White House on that. Egypt obviously was involved in that as well. And even Morocco has come out supporting it.
But the Palestinians don't. And it's dead on arrival. It's a terrible plan.
Well, I think every time there's a peace plan, it's always DOA. I mean, we can go back and look at, you know, all the plans that have been proposed over time. I mean, you know, people talk about the UN Resolution 242 from 1967. So if you remember when Israel was invaded in 1967, was successful in actually pushing back the Jordanians and others that were invading, which is why we have the so-called those green zones right now, or what people call the occupied territory. There was immediately a resolution in the UN, and Israel supported it. And the whole idea was, look, you invaded us, but we don't want the land, take it back. We just want peace, and we want recognition of our right to exist. And that then resulted in the famous Arab League meeting in Khartoum, Sudan. In Khartoum, when they said no to the right to exist, no to state of Israel, you start with that in 67, and then you have people that are saying, oh, well, you know, we still need to go back to that resolution. And I think to myself, well, every time there's been a peace plan proposed, whether it was the Oslo Accords or the other one, Taba, it's always been no. And I think it's the failure of the Palestinian leadership. And quite frankly,
I cannot come down on them on this one. There was nothing offered to them. This was a one-way street. I think it was a political ploy to help Bibi, who was there a long time. And some of the commentators, Dan Levy, who was involved in a bunch of the prior peace plans.
He's involved in Taba and the second Oslo.
And he calls this a hate plan.
He does. But I think I had two comments on Dan. I mean, one, he is on the advisory council for J Street. And J Street is a partisan organization, so I take that into account with Dan.
But so is AIPAC.
But AIPAC's not AIPAC's bipartisan. AIPAC, I don't think, has made any statement on the peace plan that I'm aware of. But I'm looking at like Brett Stevens. I thought Brett Stevens had a really great piece in the New York Times.
He's a real conservative columnist. I mean, he comes from a conservative view. He was a Republican. Now he's not pro Trump. He's not pro.
I never knew Brett Stevens to be a Republican. I never knew to be pro Trump either.
He's not pro Trump.
But it's not just Brett Stevens. I mean, there's a lot of discussion and debate out there. Even
but it
in
offers
the Arab
nothing.
World.
It offers nothing to the.
I would disagree with that. I mean, if we go back to the original peace plan, and you can look at all the discussions. If you had Christian Labarge, you had Christian Labarge there from IMF, you had the head of Bank of Africa, you had financial leaders from all over the world that were present just, 6 months ago at phase one. And it was the first time there was a comprehensive launch of an economic stimulus plan of this is what we want to do, because we want to bring the Palestinian people into a place of prosperity.
Who was there representing the Palestinians?
But if you remember, the Palestinian Authority forbade it. They actually forbade it. And there were a handful of Palestinian business people from Hebron, for instance, that went to it because they said, look, we are very interested in this. We want peace. We want to see what happens. And what did they do? As soon as they returned home, they were immediately arrested by the Palestinian Authority. So I think this is where there is, and we saw this even when it was first launched, there were a lot of Palestinians outside of the PA that were writing articles and opinions saying, listen, we need to give an opportunity and a chance. Let's look at what we have. And this might bring us to a place of prosperity.
So, this is terrible. I think that Jared Kushner is arrogant with some of the things he said about the Palestinians. He called them a pitiful people.
I read the article. I didn't see that he actually said that. I thought that's what that was the commentator's assessment of what he said. But he was commenting on the leadership, and I think this is. But this goes back to, if you look at the PLO and Arafat, and you look at the Hamas manifesto, it says it right there in black and white. As Arafat said many times, we will never agree to Israel's right to exist or to give any land to Israel. And at the end of the day, so the Fatah party is Arafat's party. And then you have Hamas, which is just like a more extreme view of it because they don't feel like Fatah is fighting hard enough. And so you have this leadership that no matter how many times there have been multiple opportunities where, you know, under Bill Clinton and everyone else, where, look, we're going to give you everything you want. You could have had a peace deal years ago, and the one thing that stopped it was that Abbas wouldn't agree to the right of a Jewish state to exist. He's like, I'm not gonna agree to that. And then the peace accord fell apart.
I think that's where this is frustration.
And I think that, but the Palestinian people, I think it's matter. I think the problem here is that everybody's, you know, instead of saying no right off the bat, which Abbas is always going to say because he has no choice, because that's the basis of his existence, of his party. But, you know, I think the question is, come to the table.
They create a two-state solution, which I am pro-Israel. I'm in favor of a two-state solution. But they give the Palestinians no right to control their territories. That Israel is the one that controls all of the access to the various parts of the Palestinian, the part that they've carved up into various Palestinian parts, whether people can go and come. The Palestinians don't have self-determination in this plan.
I'm not sure that's right. I mean, look, there's a couple of things that they actually did. I mean, first of all, they have assured that the Muslims will always have access and that Jordan continues to be the one who controls the Temple Mount. And they've made it very clear that they will allow Muslims and they will not stop any Muslims from coming to the Temple Mount to go to Al-Aqsa Mosque. And I think that was a very important piece, that they maintain that control. It provides a capital for the Palestinian state in East Jerusalem. I guess this is where Abbas needs to have a part. Abbas has refused to negotiate. He's refused to have any conversation. I think that's part of the problem. It's like, you know, and whether you like the administration or not, because I don't want to politicize it. I think the issue
but it is a politicized type thing, Laureen.
Every president for the last 30 years has said, I'm going to bring peace. I mean, they all try to put out a peace deal. So, but the point being is that Abbas has refused. The Palestinian Authority since 2007 has refused to come to the table and really have any dialogue on the issue. So have a dialogue. But it does create a Palestinian state. There are these various enclaves.
Israel will control all security, territorial waters, airspace, and international crossings of the non-state and can even maintain a permanent blockade. That's part of the peace.
That's on certain positions. Okay, so there are certain security issues, but the Palestinian Authority, so first of all, it does a couple of things. It says Hamas has to demilitarize. They have to. Hamas has to demilitarize because they have been, and even Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, has been pushing Hamas to demilitarize. That's why the Fatah and Hamas still haven't reached a resolution themselves, because of that. Israel needs to have actual lasting peace, that needs to be a reality. It's as simple as that. But the Palestinian Authority right now, they have always had security cooperation with Israel, but the Palestinian Authority have full cooperation over their own borders. And this, what it was saying, like for instance, what you just quoted, that for instance is on the border with Egypt. That's because Egypt and Israel, you forget Egypt and Israel have a special relationship because of they've had a peace treaty since Sadat, right? And so Egypt very much wants Israel controlling that border because of their security cooperation. I think it's reading beyond some of those other things and looking a little more closer at it. I think that's what those things are talking about. And that's important. I mean, Israel will control this Golan Heights. Israel has to control the Golan Heights. Israel 20 plus years ago tried to offer the Golan back to Syria and Syria refused to come to the table. Now we've got Iran there sitting there with all their forces at the border. I mean, Israel has no choice. She has to control that border. So
why don't we do this? Time is going by. It's 12:30 already. Let me move the mic over here. And where is this over here? We have Councilman Goetz on the phone with us. Councilman, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm listening to your show. Very interesting things I didn't know about.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you.
Well, for those who don't know, do you want me to recap or do you want to recap what caused all the conflict? I'll be glad to let you tell your side. Why don't you start, say how this whole thing got started, if you will.
Well, I think it was a conversation over the phone with a local reporter, and I was upset about the cost of construction costs within the city, and I made the comment, we're getting due, and I caught myself, and I immediately apologized, because I said, somebody could take that the wrong way. I immediately apologized. I thought the reporter understood that, and then I picked up the phone talking with him about all the issues. An hour later, he came to my office and started asking about the comment, and I tried to explain to him that, that wasn't meant in any other kind of way. I said, I don't think we need to go down this road with this, and I guess he said he was taking it to his editor, and then it all unraveled on Wednesday afternoon. Just not me being ignorant to history and not knowing some key words, and this is where we're at this time.
And I know that you've met with members of the Jewish community, Rabbi Simon.
What a history lesson that was.
Yeah.
Right. And Joe Probasco, the current president of the Federation.
And Mendy Dabrowski.
Rabbi Mendy Dabrowski, correct.
What I wonder, though, if we took, and I think you are sincere, we talked yesterday as a matter of fact, I think you are sincere. How would you have reacted if a white city councilman had used the N-word?
I think, when you look at the N-word sometimes, Mike, what context was it used in? Usually when you use the N-word, it's really toward hate, someone's skin color. And I think from as a little boy, we've all been told that that's a real, real bad word. But some words in our community, which I didn't know, the word ghetto, we use all the time in my community. But I didn't know that that was established with the Jewish community.
Sure.
Right.
I didn't know some other traditions, throwing a penny in front of a Jewish person. A lot of traditional things that I just didn't know, the peanut guy. Things I didn't really know and understood, because in my community, the word gyp is commonly used. But if we had a big gypsy community, that's
right.
Right.
The gypsies.
Wow. Absolutely.
And Councilman, this is Lorraine Jaffe. I applaud your courage for coming on the show and your openness for dialogue. Because this is a very important issue, and I think the fact that you are willing to have a dialogue speaks very highly of your character. I think just as I believe many in the Black community, there's a lot of sensitivities. I think a lot of people will say things and not realize how that's offensive. Even as you just mentioned, for gypsies, for instance, if somebody says you got gypped off, there's a lot of things in our dialogue sometimes as kids we've heard, and they've just been accepted in normal parlance. And sometimes we don't realize how that really is based, the foundation of it at some point was bigotry. Even if when you're saying it, you don't mean it in a hateful, bigoted manner, that it is taken that way and it can be offensive to that community. I've certainly have heard, somebody who didn't know I was Jewish saying, oh, did you Jew him down? Meaning, did you get a good deal? Were you able to get the price down? And it's kind of like that thing. And they... you know, I don't know if they're being innocent or not, but it is some of those things that are part of that common parlance. And I think this is really a great opportunity for us to open dialogue because between the Jewish and the Black communities, because we've always been, you know, so close with each other.
I was thinking to that fact too. I didn't know back in '64 you had one of the rabbis who was with the marches and things like that, and Jewish people were together with Black people.
A lot of the freedom riders were Jewish people who came from up north to the South to participate in the Jewish community was very influential and positive about ending the discrimination and was pushing the Civil Rights Act.
Right.
They were closely aligned. And I don't know, somehow, in some ways, we have gotten off base.
We have. And it's kind of a strange thing. I would also mention, even I think it's still going on at the Florida Holocaust Museum. They've had a display out. They change it every couple months, but they've had their current display, I think, is addressing specifically in the larger Tampa area, but it is focusing on the civil rights movement here in this community, as well as the Jews who were involved in that, and I think and it's an important part of the conversation.
I look at in my community, you know, around my friends and in our community, you very rarely hear the word African American. You'll hear Black, mm-hmm. but if you're in some type of setting, you'll hear African American,
mm-hmm.
and that was a term that came out in '84. But when I was growing up, that wasn't a term; it was Black.
Right,
right.
You know, it's just, you know, I think. The problem we have is our school system that we're not teaching history. I'm listening to your show about the Palestinians and Israel. Most people in my community they don't know nothing about that. They don't know what's going on, why we have these wars or whatever. I think it's time to have the conversation of how do we get to teaching folks about culture and what is permissible and what's not and what's offensive. You know, and I just think we just have a conversation. I always look at everything happens for a reason. I believe in God and I believe everything happens in. I think this is for me to speak out and try to make some things happen within the city and talk to our school board personnel as well.
Let me ask you this. I always like to turn, if we can, a negative into a positive.
Right.
You're an influential leader of the city. Like I told you, I don't know you very well, but I've heard good things about you. How can we make this a positive to make people more aware? What would you suggest we do as the Jewish community and that you can do with the Black community and so we can come together and make this a positive for both of us?
Well, I talked to Rabbi Simon and Mimi. I think I'm going to work with Rabbi Mimi as far as police relations and our implicit bias thing that's probably going to be coming back to us on city council. And I can maybe implement and talk about these type of things to get things implemented.
For those that don't know, you spent several years as a Tampa police officer.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So I've worked all communities and I've told people. So that's why I was very hurt when the gentleman wrote the article. I was at hatred, and that's not true. But I think you look at communities, we need to get what maybe all the pastors, there are two pastoral groups in Tampa, right, pastoral groups, maybe get the Jewish community and some of the other communities to come together and talk about these type of issues and come up with some solutions to be able to teach and train.
I think that is terrific,
right.
And I want to let you know that you have a forum here on our show. Anytime you come up with something that we can, let's make this a negative, a learning experience, and turn it into a positive. I think that will be a good thing. Everybody makes a mistake. I have made some boneheaded mistakes in my life. I think you are sincere about this, so I applaud you for that. And let's hope we can make this a positive.
Well, that's the goal, is you don't know to know. I said a lot of times on city council when people bring things, we don't know that to know. So now that I know, we need to try to fix it and move forward and make some things happen.
Right. That's perfect. Well, thank you so much, Councilman, for being with us today. Again, for those listening, this is City Council Member Orlando Goods. Am I saying your last name right? Goods? G-U-D-E-S?
Hey, on the money.
Perfect. So, City Councilman Orlando Goods, thank you again for joining us. And again, with just being willing to have the dialogue and confronting it head on and your honesty, we greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, I really do. I'm gonna stop downtown either this week or next. Maybe we can have a cup of coffee.
That'd be fine, Mike. My office is always open to the community. Everyone knows if I can't get to you, I'll come out to your house and speak with you about any issue that's going on and we'll make it happen.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day today.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. Let's take a little break, then we've got something going. This is WMNF, The Third Opinion. We'll be right back. is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe. So we've got an interview that I think is really fantastic. So Deborah Lipstadt, some of you may know the name from the movie that came out several years ago, Denial. Deborah Lipstadt, she's an author. She is very outspoken on anti-Semitism. She's also a professor at Emory University. Focuses on Jewish studies. And that movie dealt with this instance where there was a Holocaust denier who was attacking her and just wouldn't stop harassing her, and then went after her for slander because she said, no, the Holocaust did happen, and she just wouldn't push back. So it's quite an interesting film. But she was here, I got to hear her in town about a week ago on her new book, Anti-Semitism Here and Now. And what I really loved about her dialogue is that even as we just had the councilman on, so I think it's very timely, there are a lot of things that people sometimes say in our culture, and they don't appreciate that it's anti-Semitic, that the foundation of those comments are based in bigotry, and how it can be offensive. Now, there are people who are just clearly making anti-Semitic statements, but they completely deny that they're anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. Like, oh no, but like, you know what you just said? Yes, and why did you say it? Well, because of so and so, and like, okay, so that's anti-Semitic. And so there's these people that really want to believe that we're not anti-Semitic at all, but then they don't want to take instruction on their comments, and then there's just the blatant anti-Semitism. So her book goes into great detail, but we were able to get a quick interview with her. So that's what we're going to jump into right now.
Okay, our special correspondent, Sherry Silverman. Spit it out.
Sherry Silverman.
had a chance to catch up with her, and this is what Sherry got for us for this.
Professor, sadly, anti-Semitism has been around for far too long and has shown up in different ways over the years and around the world. What, if anything, is different about modern-day anti-Semitism?
Well, the things that are different and things that are the same. The template is the same. The stereotypical charges, the prejudicial charges, are the same. What's being said today is not that different from what we've heard over many, many years, including in the 1930s from the Germans. What's different today is we're seeing it on the political right and on the political left and from Islamist extremists.
Can you explain for our listeners what you describe as clueless anti-Semitism?
Yes. Clueless anti-Semitism is very important. It's not as dangerous as what we saw in Pittsburgh or in San Diego or in other places where there were actual murders. But it's committed by people who don't even realize they're being anti-Semitic. And the story I tell in my book is of a friend of mine who was graduating from nursing school, and she was with a group of her very close friends. They had been friends throughout the years in nursing school, and they knew she was Jewish. They were in her home, and they admired her Jewishness, etc. And then one of them was telling, when they were having a lunch at the very end before graduation, they were talking about what they were going to miss. The school was in New York. And one of them said, oh, I'm going to miss a store, and she named the name of a store where you get lots of bargains. It was the original discount shopping place. But as she said that, she turned to my friend and said, oh, you're going to like be interested in this, as opposed to everyone else around the table. So, and my friend said, oh, I didn't know Jews were the only ones concerned enough to want to save their hard-earned money. And the young woman got it. So in other words, sometimes when you engage in anti-Semitism without even realizing... When you engage in anti-Semitism without even realizing you're engaging in anti-Semitism.
We can hear people making jokes based on stereotypes like the one you just mentioned. In fact, mm-hmm. The name of this radio show kind of does just that, where Jews are very opinionated. So the name of the show is called Third Opinion. There are two hosts, two right. Jews, three opinions. And it's funny, we all chuckle with it. But another one that comes up, just the one you mentioned, is that Jews are too cheap with money. Is there any level of general stereotyping that you think is normal or acceptable? If so, how do we recognize when such statements have gone too far across the line?
You know, I don't think stereotyping is ever acceptable. You know, imagine if we had if a blonde person did something to you didn't like, and you began to say all blonde people are like that, or a left-handed person said something. They're Jews who are very generous, and they're Jews who are stingy. They're Jews who are smart, and they're Jews who are not smart. They're Jews who are very affable and friendly and want to meet other people, and they're Jews who want to stick to. Jews are normal people like other people. What is not normal, in a sense, is the way the world has expressed its venom towards Jews. And sometimes people ask Jews, well, why is there anti-Semitism? And the legitimate answer really is, don't ask me, ask the anti-Semite. You know, it's like saying to the woman who's been attacked, or the woman, why did they rape you? And just don't ask me, ask the rapist, or the child who's been the victim of pedophilia. The child didn't do anything, it's the aggressor. But it's the victim who gets hurt, so the victim bleeds, so that's why the victims were always more concerned about it.
In your book, Anti-Semitism Here and Now, the character Abigail describes an occasion where she's in a group discussion and someone makes a comment by a classmate who downplayed the seriousness of anti-Semitism by saying that Jews are always playing the Holocaust card and they aren't suffering because they're white and privileged. And Abigail knew there were so many things wrong with this statement, but she didn't know how to respond. What advice can you give to people who know that we should all have an obligation sometimes to dispel false statements, yet they feel they're not equipped to know what to say when challenged?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote my book, and I wrote it in the forms of letters and questions and answers to make it as accessible to people as possible, is to give them ammunition, to give them information on how to respond. Sometimes it's very hard to know exactly what to say. But it is true, Abigail had that experience in her seminar, or Abigail's fictional, but a student of mine had that experience with a guy. The student said, Jews aren't victims, they're wealthy, you're comfortable. First of all, not all Jews are wealthy, but that's beside the point. Jews present differently from other victims of prejudice. Generally, when we talk about victims of prejudice, we're thinking of people of color, maybe Muslims today, who may not be as comfortable in the society, may not be as, financially secure, etc. But Jews, that doesn't mean Jews can't be victims. And the fact of the matter is that if you go back and look at the Jewish community of Germany in the 1930s, they look very much like the American Jewish community. Things can change on a dime. I'm not saying that that's what's going to happen in this country, but the fact that we are comfortable and we don't look like other victims doesn't mean that it isn't out there.
You wrote an article recently following a string of horrific anti-Semitic attacks at the end of 2019, one which involved the stabbing of multiple people at a Hanukkah celebration at a rabbi's home in New York. The title of the article is Jews Are Going Underground, where you account for a concerning and distressing trend where Jews are concealing their Jewish identity and keeping information about services and celebrations private for safety reasons. Why do you believe this is so troublesome?
I think because people are frightened. I'm not saying it's a worldwide phenomenon, but I know many people who used to wear a kippah, head covering, a little cap in the street, and now wear a hat or a baseball cap or something. There's nothing wrong with that, but there's a nervousness. You know, I, ever the contrarian, when I read that article about the synagogue in the Netherlands where they no longer post the time of services, you have to call up, you have to know someone. They won't tell you if you call up what time they are because they're afraid. I went out and bought a Jewish star, and I now wear a Jewish star. So, showing it to you right now, Wonders of Radio. You can't see it, but it's there.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
All right, well, we have to wrap up, but I always like to end with one culinary question. And I know, unfortunately, you had to spend some time in Britain because of the trial. So fish and chips or bangers and mash?
Fish and chips.
All right. You're very confident about that.
Yes.
Well, thank you for being
here.
You're
welcome. My pleasure.
Spending your time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was really fascinating. You know, I've mentioned this before. When the whole Bucks threat of moving to another city went on, when the Glazers bought the Buccaneers, I was in groups of people doing interviews, and they didn't realize I was Jewish. And they would say disparaging things about Jews, the Glazers being, you know, the Jews that bought the team. And I really was conflicted whether to speak up and say, excuse me, I'm Jewish, or to stock it away so I could go, you know, here's an icon of the community who's really a prejudicial SOB. And that's what I did. And I don't know if that was the right decision or not, but that's what I did.
And I think that's pretty much why we have this show, right, is when our primary purpose is to have these dialogues on anti-Semitism, because it is, we are seeing this tremendous rise across the board throughout Europe, throughout the United States. There was an article even this week I was reading in Los Angeles we've talked a lot about New York, but the rise of anti-Semitic attacks just last year in 2019 in Los Angeles,
skyrocketed.
All the places skyrocketed.
And in France, you sent me the article about France.
That's
too.
Right.
It is, and people say, well, why do you dwell so much on anti-Semitism? I'll tell you why. It's dangerous, it's scary, and it's happening. And if we don't talk about it, it just grows and grows and grows.
That's right. And have a dialogue on some of as she mentioned, some of the things that people are just clueless about, and then other things that are blatant and everything in between. I think it's having that conversation and educating and informing. So we do this a lot. This is why we're having these dialogues. I really enjoyed listening to her. I think we have a call.
Yeah, right? We have Mark in St. Pete. Mark, you want to talk about the peace plan, right? Mark?
Are you there?
Hello, Mark.
Mark, hello.
Mark?
Yes.
Are you with us?
Yes.
Okay.
We're getting an
You're
echo.
On the air.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit of an
Are you
echo
listening on the radio? You got to turn your radio down.
I was, but I turned it down. Thank you.
Okay.
I just wanted to give a different perspective on the origins of the Palestinian issue.
Okay, let me do one thing. Absolutely, we're going to let you do it, but I didn't mention the phone numbers before we came to you, and I should do that. It's 813-239-9663 if you want to join us. Go ahead, Mark. You got the floor.
Thank you. Everybody continuously is focusing on the last attack or the last issue of the peace process or the non-peace process. It seems to me that we're losing track of the history, because it's always presented that this attack by the Palestinians or this day of rage or this nationalistic outburst, this intifada, that intifada, is the result of something that Israel did. But all of the security measures that are forced to be taken are in response to an ongoing series of Palestinian terrorist attacks and terrorist issues that go back even before the founding of the State of Israel. So I think that it would behoove people on all sides to go back and look at what Israel was forced to deal with at its inception in 1948. Zionism goes back more than 100 years in an organized European fashion before the creation of the State of Israel.
I mean, Mark, you're right. The League of Nations in 1917, I think, said that there should be an Israeli country, and then it never manifested itself until 48. But you're right. It didn't just happen in 48. It goes way back, more than 100 years. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I thought that's a significant point.
Thank you. And I agree with that. Unfortunately, there's been a history of Arab, Muslim, Palestinian terrorism against the Jewish people of Israel, even before the 1948 creation of Israel, which is probably one of the most legitimate political processes in the world. You have the entire world voting to create the State of Israel. And we should also look back and think, what would have happened had the Palestinian people and the Arab nations surrounding Israel in 1948 not attacked and accepted the partition plan that the world voted on?
Right.
If 70 years of peace, where would the Palestinian people be today? So it seems like most of the progress that could have been made has been put into wars and tunnels and murder and intifadas and rejecting
every single issue and peace plan that's ever been put forth by anybody. So I think the world holds Israel to an incredible double standard. There's nonstop rocket attacks, nonstop terrorist attacks. There's a culture that teaches hatred to their children and willingly sacrifices their children in the name of resistance.
Right. We agree with you, Mark. So much of this is documented. It's documented, as we mentioned earlier, the Hamas Manifesto, the Grand Mufti who started the Muslim Brotherhood. That was obviously the intention. He was very active with Hitler, supported the Nazi movement. The Mizrahi Jews who lived throughout the Middle East and throughout Northern Africa, Persia, et cetera, literally being kicked out of the countries that they lived in for hundreds, if not thousands of years in certain situations, and went to, at the time, the land of Palestine, and there were always Jews living in what was called the land of Palestine, which was never a country. It was always territory occupied, whether it was by the Ottoman Turks or prior conquerors. But it's a complicated dialogue, unfortunately. And you know, even before the founding of 48, as you mentioned, the Hebron massacre, the Jews that were slaughtered in Hebron, which is a date that is still celebrated annually, you know, to date, every year. Even I think we mentioned on the show before, Abbas put out a big proclamation on the annual anniversary of that date when the Jews were slaughtered there. But it's complicated, and I think that's part of why we always have these conversations. It's you can't look at it in a sort of myopic perspective. It's a very complicated, difficult.
It's not a monolithic.
Yeah.
Mark, thanks for your call. We got a bunch of folks waiting. So let's go to Rob in Thanota Sassa. Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, I think you got me. This is Simon from Lakeland.
Oh, Simon, how are you?
Good. I'll keep it real quick. You know, anti-Semitism is very complex. When they asked James Joyce, the Nobel Prize winner for literature who wrote Ulysses, why Ireland never had a Jewish problem, he said, we never let them in. And so when you think of anti-Semitism, you don't have to have a direct exposure, direct experience. It's very complex. England kicked out the Jews in 1290. Right. They didn't let them in until the mid-17th century, but yet you had Shakespeare and Shylock, and you had Oliver Twist, and you had Fagin. And so the perception of what a Jew is also in literature. It's in songs. And so it's very complex. I'll leave you with this. When you talk about anti-Semitism, you're truly not getting to the heart of it. It's like talking about crime, but not talking about who's committing the crime.
That's true. Simon, we got a lot of calls, and let me move on, but thank you so much for calling. That's a real valid point. All right, now let's try. Rob, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Sorry, I screwed up the buttons. And
let me practice my opening. listen, here's what I wanted to make a point about, and it's not spoken of in the media, which concentrates on Israel's deficiencies in this current offering, but isn't it true that the right of return is still being insisted upon by the Palestinians, anyone in the negotiating position, which, if I understand it correctly, means any Arab who was either left or was expelled or fled Israel when the war of independence was fought, has the right not to come back to the whatever designated areas the Arabs live in, but to Israel proper, which of course would destroy, and that's all the people in the refugee camps up, you know, in Jordan and elsewhere. So if they don't agree to that, there can be no deal, no matter what the other parameters are.
The problem, Rob, and I understand there are a lot of issues to deal with the Arabs. This plan is so, in my mind, one way for Israel. When you negotiate with people, each side has to give a little bit. It can't be just one way and expect the other person to go, yeah, okay, I'm going to accept that.
And I agree. But do you think that if Netanyahu brought a deal with Jared Kushner or Trump and saying, we're going to give you a contiguous area, West Bank, parts of the West Bank, we'll give you half of Jerusalem, we'll give you Gaza, you govern it yourselves, you have, you know, all of these things. but you can't have the right of return, and you have to give us the right to exist officially. Do you think they would go for that?
No, probably not. They wouldn't, because they've been given everything. They've been asked
That's what I'm saying. That's my point.
Yeah, but there's a place to negotiate when you hit. If you say they put that plan out.
All right, but hold on, Mike. Okay, yeah. I got to respond to Rob's comment earlier, because you agree with him, and you didn't agree with him, and I agree with you, Rob. The point of this is there is this politicization of treating these Palestinians. I mean, there are Palestinians living here in America, living very prosperous lives, that are still defined. They are the only group of people for generations that will be defined as refugees by the United Nations. No other people group on the face of the earth. And what's happened is there are very small, limited refugee camps in the Palestinian Authority today. Most Palestinians do not live in them. But it is a political ploy that has been used by the leadership of Fatah and PLO and others. And people hang keys on their doors saying, you know, we're ready to return one day. We're going to go back into Jerusalem, into Israel, and take our land back. And they use this as a political ploy to keep people stuck in this perpetual state of this mindset of poverty, even though the Palestinian Authority itself actually flourishes. People are very well educated. There's lots of wealth and prosperity there. You don't really ever hear about that. But it's part of that political ploy. But what we're seeing for the first time is this shift, right? So Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Jordan, were three of the five Arab countries that invaded Israel in the 1948 war, the other two being Lebanon and Syria, that rejected Israel's right to exist. But three of those five now have come, and they're supporting this peace plan. They're supporting the idea of, like, look, we need a solution. This, you know, it was a bad idea. We've done this resistance. We've rejected every opportunity. And we actually, these three, so you have these three nations.
They don't have a seat at the table.
It doesn't matter if every nation in the world, it does matter that these nations are the ones that have been supporting the Palestinian plight all these years and perpetuating the political debate.
But it doesn't matter if it doesn't offer anything to the Palestinians.
I disagree. It actually offers them a capital in East Jerusalem. It gives full access to Muslims at all times to the Temple Mount. They have statehood. They have no right of self-determination. They actually do have self-determination.
Israel is in charge.
No, Israel's not in charge. They actually, their own government, their own rulership. I don't know what you're reading where you're getting that information, because I've been through the whole plan.
No, I have too. Israel is in charge. They do not have their own self.
Israel's not in charge. They have their own government. They rule themselves.
No, they've got to get permission from Israel. No, you're wrong. I'm sorry, Lorraine. You're wrong on this.
I'm not wrong. You know history better than I do.
But this plan.
I've been through the plan.
I have too.
Yes, there, in great detail. And it does.
No, it does not.
Okay.
All right.
Anyway, other callers.
Let's go to Jay.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Rob. Here's Jay in Sarasota. Jay.
Yeah, I just have Saudi Arabia is a friend of America, and Netanyahu recently, maybe a year or so, or a little under a year ago, Leslie Stahl asked Netanyahu what he thought of Saudi Arabia in relation to Israel. Well, they're changing. We're working things out. There's two Islams, and the Islam of Sharia law, which is Saudi Arabia, where women have no rights, is probably, in my opinion, one of the most vile countries of the world. And your leader, who's trying to stay in power right now, is using that.
I don't exactly understand. You mean Netanyahu?
The relationship that they can have in Israel. He said that on Leslie Collins 30 Minutes.
Yeah, well, Saudi Arabia is significant. Again, when you think about the Arab world, Israel lives in a very dangerous neighborhood. And talking about Bahrain, Oman, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, Egypt, Morocco, Jordan have all come out and supported the plan. And it's important because these are organizations, these are countries that have financially supported.
We'll have to pick it up next week.
We're out of time.
This is the third opinion.
There we go.
I'm Mike Deason. See you next week. Have a good Super Bowl Sunday. Bye.
Listening to WMNF Tampa. Today is Sunday, February 2nd, 2020. I'm Joy Katzen Guthrie. Welcome to the Sunday Symphony.